philosophers in
space, 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 space.
Gotta be my pal. Tell me, am I a good man?
My space armor!
We get it, you're from space!
Captain, we've been attacked by some sort of force ray. Space air is flooding in.
What would Uncle do?
Zuko, you have to look within yourself to save yourself from your other self.
Hello and welcome to Philosophers in Space. It's episode 87. Part 3 of Blindsight. I'm Thomas, that's Aaron. How you doing, Aaron?
I've just been totally destroyed by trying to work my way through this book. Again, my mind has been shattered and put back together by space vampires, and I don't even know what's real anymore, man.
Well, I've been the ship the whole time, this whole podcast, all 87 episodes. Mm-hmm. I was actually the ship.
I was a ship.
None
reveal.
Of you idiots saw it coming.
It's a pretty standard reveal.
Spoiler alert. Do we ever have Brian make something for that? Brian, make something for that. Punch it. Spoiler alert. Because we're going to discuss the ending of the book, Blindsight. It's not, you know, it's not like The Sixth Sense or anything, I don't think. It's not a, wouldn't ruin the book for you if you knew the ending, but anyway, that's the spoiler alert. Consider yourselves alerted.
So I have a question.
And also, I was the ship the whole time.
Do you think you need a spoiler alert for a Chekhov's vampire? Like, if you have, like, a vampire in the first act and you know it's going to go off, like, do you really need a spoiler for that?
I don't know, man. I don't really understand a lot of what happened at the end of this book, so.
It all happens rather fast.
And I'm not blaming the book. It's, you know. It's an unintuitive environment just as a whole. Mm-hmm. Like, we got vampires, we got AI, we got multiple personality thingy, a person that's different people. We got Rorschach, the I guess villain. I don't know. I got the bad guy, the alien, the thing that's like, we don't know if it's sentient, we don't know if it's conscious, but
yeah,
it's definitely
the antagonist.
Yeah. Yeah. And we're also going to talk about, in addition to finishing off the story, we're going to talk about moral realism, which is always a fun topic. I like that topic. And yeah. I'm curious to see how it ties in with space vampires, which it does. All right. Brian, punch it.
I just can't do it, Captain. I don't have the power.
Okay, that's the second punch it. He's got, you know, I don't need to say Brian punch a different thing because he knows, right? He just knows.
Yeah.
You know? We got.
He said explicitly that punching it is the favorite part of it every day.
So we're in the exposition zone now, and where do we need to start? I need your help with this because it's a jumble of space vampires and stuff.
Yeah. So where we left off, they were like doing their B&E on Rorschach and like trying to get information, and they tangled with the scramblers. And then I think
scrambled with the tanglers.
Yeah. And then I think the main stuff we want to talk about from the ending is they pick up a couple of scramblers. They catch them and essentially in a net and bring them back to study them, and like do experiments on them and stuff like that. And then they realize sort of halfway through that process that these are not in fact captives, but are spies who were deliberately allowed to be captured. Super twist, for the sake of getting information about them. And then Rorschach uses an energy blast to like break them free, and they head back to Rorschach, and then Rorschach disappears into the super gas giant, and they're like, well, we have no idea what's going on, we're totally screwed, it's probably going to come murder us. And then it does in fact come and murder them. And the end of the story is like you said, it's very rough and tumble. It's very fast. And yeah, we get a sort of weird reveal that it appears, it's not 100% clear, but it looks like it might be the case that the vampire was always being controlled by the AI of the ship.
Yeah.
That he was never actually, and like it's a weird reveal. I'm not sure what the point exactly is supposed to be.
Yeah, okay. Well, I was gonna I was gonna ask you what the hell the point of that was, because I was already good with vampires. I didn't need a thing behind the space vampires.
Yeah, I don't know.
Oh, this is just an innocent space vampire. No need to explore. Oh, what a twist! You know, like it was already a space vampire. That's close enough. Plus, not to mention the fact that we're not sure if vampires are entirely, you know, sentient in the way that we are.
Mm-hmm.
Do you even know, like, what are the mechanics of the ship controlling the vampire? Well,
they have a direct neural uplink, apparently, and that's as far as I know. I don't think it's very thoroughly sort of dives into what's going on there. And when Siri asks the AI, so basically what happens is shit hits the fan. The vampire gets killed, but his body keeps moving, essentially, because the AI is controlling him. And then, like, the AI takes Siri to an escape pod to get him out of there with all the information
hold on.
Gathered.
Important question. Does this make him a space vampire zombie?
An artificially intelligent space vampire zombie, I think, would be the full way to describe
this
character.
A space vampire zombie that's being necromancied by an artificial intelligence.
Yeah, there's a lot of layers.
We've got at least 3 to 4 classes involved. D&D classes or whatever.
This is what happens when you've been playing the game too long and you've gotten bored of the standard classes. This is what the result is.
Space vampire zombie minion of a
robot.
Space
vampire zombie minion robot. And when Siri asks the space vampire zombie minion robot why this ridiculously convoluted plot had to be executed, the answer is because you don't like taking orders from artificial intelligence. I guess. And I'm not,
but
there isn't,
like,
a lot of time
they,
for
are they in love with
on
taking
them.
Orders from vampires?
Exactly, right. Like, and like, I think Siri essentially said something like, yeah, because vampires was so much better. But I'm also just confused that why these super advanced human guys, people, wouldn't want to just take advice from the machine. Like, they're all half machine.
Yeah, it doesn't
anyway.
Make a whole lot of sense.
No, it's a little bit Shyamalan-y, in a sense. A little M. Night.
It's unnecessary. Didn't need that last twist.
There's a lot of cool stuff going on.
Already,
I agree with
you. Yeah, there's plenty of cool stuff. You wouldn't read this book and be like, you know what I need?
Yeah.
I needed one more weird twist. No, it was fine. There's lots of twists.
Yeah. No, but like, aside from that kind of little bit of confusing weirdness, I really like the ending. It's basically like, you know, full-fledged Rorschach goes head-on against the ship. The ship kicks Siri out and do like a... like decades long slow return to Earth on one of the one of the lifeboat kind
escape
of vessels
pods or something.
Yeah, and then the ship, I think, basically drives straight into Rorschach as like a giant atom bomb situation and an attempt to try to destroy it and buy, I guess, Earth some time, essentially. And then the last cool twist, which I think is perfectly well earned, is that on his way back, he's like listening to the chatter of, you know, ships and things back around Earth. And he, though it's never explicitly said, he gets the distinct impression that all of the humans are being slowly killed off by the vampires. So at the race war. Yeah, exactly. And so at the very end, he's like, you know, I read this, I think, back in the After Dark for the first episode, you know, with all the humans gone on Earth and everyone on Theseus gone, he might be the last conscious being in the universe.
Wow.
And he's not even sure if he's conscious fully.
I mean, I'm pretty sure. I'm going to go ahead and say he is. Siri, if you're listening, you're conscious.
Siri conscious, yeah.
What was the AI's motivations in this? Do we know? Was it... I mean, clearly it wanted to kill Rorschach, so it's not like the AI... That's why the twist is weird. It didn't really matter, right? Because the ship wasn't, like, teaming up with Rorschach or anything, was it?
Yeah, I agree. Like, as far as I can tell, the AI is thoroughly benevolent. Like, it just genuinely cares about the... Like, it's properly aligned is what I'm saying. And so I think you're right that, like, the reveal would only be weird if it, like, wasn't properly aligned.
AI starts, like... wreaking havoc and killing people all around the world. I gotta take my AI for an alignment.
Get that thing aligned.
Take it to the shop. Been a while since I aligned it.
Yeah, I mean, I think the only reason behind it is that, like, the whole book is about this multidimensional game theory chess, and so it's just one final layer of that, you know, 36-degree chess.
All right, well, there you have it, everybody.
Yeah.
The human race is extinct.
Or maybe.
Maybe.
Maybe. Or maybe Siri gets back and he survives and he repopulates or something. Who knows? Who knows?
Just by himself, yeah.
Yeah, by himself. I don't know. Maybe he crossbreeds with the vampires. You don't know.
Then I wonder if you could make a deal with the space vampires to be like, all right, you bested us, but can you just hook us all into this AI afterlife that we have, apparently, and just like maintain a little server farm of us? You know, would that be cool? Like, as a just as a, you know?
Yeah, it's a good question. Like, we surrender. They'd want to do that because they could just feed on them whenever they wanted to. So. But yeah, I don't know
that their bodies are still there. I think their brains are just in the cloud.
Oh, you just the fully uploaded version. Yeah, they talk about that.
Yeah, I mean,
would
it be the worst? I guess what I don't know what's in it for the vampires, and they clearly don't have any compassion, so maybe they wouldn't do it anyway. But still, like, would it be that hard? Just be like, hey, give us this afterlife, would you?
And I want to read the sequel, and I'm sure someone's going to tell me this already exists, where now the space vampires have to figure out Rorschach, right? Like, they kill off all the humans, get them out of the way, but they still got this larger threat on the horizon, and they've got to, like, send off a whole fleet of space vampires to go fight Rorschach. That'd be pretty cool, no?
Yeah, that would be that'd be a good battle. That'd be a well-earned battle, I think.
It'd be a lot of fun. So, yeah, I think it's just a really cool story about the way that, like, by setting up the idea that we are, I love the way they describe it in the back half, that, like, consciousness is, that we are on Earth, like, foolish flightless birds, essentially, like dodos who just think that we're super advanced, but the only reason we're surviving is because we're just lucky enough to be far enough away from the monsters for long enough, and that, like, the real universe out there is full of non-conscious beings who are just surviving because that's the more effective way to be in the universe.
Well, they don't, I think definitionally they don't really have any choice in the matter. It's just, they're just these reproducing, thriving, non-sentient thingies.
Yep.
So pivot to philosophy then, I guess.
Yeah. So my question is,
I'm
essentially,
all out of vampires.
Do we have a moral responsibility to those non-sentient replicating things out there in the universe? And if not, do we have a moral responsibility to anybody? So I guess maybe I'll do a little bit of background on moral realism for folks who haven't heard my shtick about this before. So moral realism is a meta-ethical theory. It's a theory about the nature of ethical claims or the ethical world that we potentially live in. And moral realism claims that there are some objective ethical truths, meaning there are certain claims about potentially the way you ought to treat certain kinds of beings that are true independent of any individual real or imagined beliefs about that particular claim. So one of the main reasons this is going to tie into this book is that for a long time, I used to think that objective moral claims largely or entirely clustered around claims about how you ought to treat sentient beings. Right. What matters is, morally speaking, how will this particular thing impact or not impact sentient beings in some kind of way? And I'm guessing there's a possibility that you probably might still believe that, that, like, even if so, let me say moral realism might be true, might apply to things other than sentient beings. But I think for a lot of people, the first stop on this train is going to be, do you feel like this even applies to sentient beings? And then can we try to expand it to non-sentient beings?
So you first want to try to go realism. You want to quickly knock out the moral realism versus not question first?
Well, I don't so much want to knock it out as that I
guess if you get rid of moral, I guess is your point that, like, if there's no such thing as moral realism, then, I mean, any moral, you'd be like, yeah, there's morality toward rocks, because, like, why not? There's any, it's all relative or something.
The opposite. I think that if you are a moral realist, you might have to take seriously the idea that we have moral obligations towards rocks.
I don't know about that. How does that work?
All right, well,
I can't wait to hear these calculations.
Well, let's get there a little bit, right? So first, I mean, let's see if the low-hanging fruit, if I can at least try to convince you that moral realism is true with regard to other sentient beings, right? So I think we have a moral obligation, all other things being equal. So it's a defeasible moral obligation. It could be overcome by other ones. To reduce the suffering, the unnecessary suffering of sentient beings, and if possible, replace it with flourishing in some kind of way. And I think that it's a fact of the matter that we ought to do that no matter what we think about those sentient beings or their particular suffering, or generally speaking, the value of sentient beings and their suffering or lack of thereof. What do you think about that?
I think I can agree with that. I really, I still think it all falls down to ultimately you need one Ott, I guess. I mean, have we talked Izzot formally on this show? I don't remember.
I don't think we have, and you're right, it's absolutely related to what we're talking about here, because what I'm essentially claiming is that there are value-laden facts, in a sense, right? There are facts that kind of bridge the fact-value divide a little bit, in which, I think it's a fact of the matter that you ought not to cause unnecessary suffering, and that has within it a thick evaluative concept like suffering and a moral claim based on the nature of suffering that you ought not to produce it, all things being equal. So there is both value and fact in there. But I sort of reject sort of some, like, the anti-realist notion that because there's value involved in that claim, it can't be an objective claim in some kind of way.
Interesting. There's a lot there. Mm-hmm. I think that we probably agree on the substance, but maybe would just describe it in a different way. I don't think it doesn't sound like I'm willing to be convinced, but I don't really see how there could be value-laden facts. I don't see how you can have a fact be that you ought to do something. I think you can only ought to do something because of something else. Like, you ought to do X, but only because there's some other reason. You know, like, if you value, there has to be a value in there of, like, suffering equals bad kind of thing.
Yes.
And if you want to define it that way or something, like, so that definitionally, then you need to avoid suffering. But then you've kind of just, you know, begged the question, haven't you? Like, I think my opinion is you need at least one ought to start with. And then the facts from there can be value laden once you have that, you know, like, foundation of, like, we ought, like, suffering equals bad, basically.
Yeah. And I'm sympathetic to that. And that's why my moral realism is a sort of nakedly foundational moral realism. I think you just have to bite the bullet and say there's a foundational truth that is objectively true, that unnecessary suffering is a bad thing and ought to be minimized as a result.
I always use the analogy, or at least this makes sense, but you can let me know if it's not a good one. But I always think of it like the rules of chess. Once you've got that, you've agreed on a value, which is you're trying to checkmate the other person or whatever.
Right.
From there, there are absolutely facts about the best way to do that. Like, there are moves that are just bad. There are moves that are better and worse.
Yeah.
And those are absolutely true given the premise. But if you run into somebody somewhere out there in the universe who's like, well, I play chess where you try to get the bishop. Like, I just want to checkmate the bishop.
Yep.
You can't, there's nothing you can do. You'd be like, well, that's stupid. I don't agree with that. But he'll be like, well, your game is stupid. I like my bishop version. And none of your rules are going to match or, like, correspond to each other. Because you have that different foundational belief.
Yeah.
But I do think that because we're just talking about humans usually, we can complicate it with vampires in a minute, but because it's basically universal that anything that suffers by definition doesn't like suffering. So, like, usually we're all playing chess basically, but it's not impossible that somebody's playing some other version of chess and then you just cannot find any common ground on that.
Okay, good. So I like this comparison, even though I disagree with it. I think it's a useful comparison to make. Because I think you're right that a lot of folks think of morality as this kind of social game that we've constructed, that we're all playing, that is to our benefit that we're all playing it, but that it isn't like some you know, system based on some truths in the world out there, right? It is like a chess game in that sense. And I think that's the thing I want to reject, that it seems to me moral truths are not like chess rules in the sense that chess rules are fully created and arbitrary in the sense that we could make a different game of chess and call it chess mm-hmm. and it wouldn't change or harm anything. Mm-hmm. Whereas moral truths are not created, they're discovered and they're not changeable in this kind of way. So if someone came along and they said that their morality involves causing unnecessary suffering for fun or for no reason whatsoever or something like that, I wouldn't say, oh, well, you just got a different kind of morality. I would say you have a broken kind of morality. You have a not functioning kind of it's failing to grasp the moral truth in this kind of way. And that can happen, right? There can all, of course, be moral disagreement. My view is that when there's moral disagreement, certain people are right and other people are wrong. And that, to me, is one of the major reasons to be in favor of moral realism, is because you can more thoroughly say, you know, it's not that we're just playing different games. It's that we've got a grasp of some kind of moral truth and you're failing to grasp it in some important way. And you can explain why. There are going to be further arguments for why that person is failing to grasp it.
Sure. I don't know. I think that, yes, moral truths are not like chess. I mm-hmm. agree that they're not entirely just created haphazardly. I do think they are a result of, honestly, biology. I think the capacity to suffer is a fact that we can't just get rid of in the universe. That fact exists. Suffering is bad. It just is. And that's the ought.
Right.
The ought to reduce suffering is there. But I would say that, which is weird, because I feel like we've switched roles somehow. I feel like maybe you just like arguing with me or vice versa.
I don't think you're just agreeing with me at this point. I think that
no, I'm not. I'm about to have the but, okay. Which is that if we meet an alien race or something, or even just a single person
mm-hmm.
who says, my morality, I don't care about other people's suffering. Mm-hmm. And you can't make me. Mm-hmm. In fact, I don't mind, you know, they like inflicting suffering. We can still say that for us, yeah, that morally sucks. But if his foundational view is that he doesn't care about causing suffering, it might be, again, a question of just word definitions, but there's no way to say, well, your morality is necessarily wrong other than to say we don't like it and it would be bad for more people.
I disagree.
He can
there.
Just say he doesn't care.
Well, also, look, okay, he can ahead. Absolutely just say he doesn't care. So I think, I don't think moral realism depends on being able to convince literally everyone of the moral truth. I don't think that, just because, I don't think any kind of realism depends on being able to convince anyone of the truth of the matter. There's always going to be people who will say, mm-hmm. I don't care what you show me, the earth is flat, and, vaccinations cause autism and stuff. So, that's a bar that no belief is going to clear. But I also think that there is more to be said about one ethical position over another than anti-realists sometimes want to let on. We can do more than just say, oh, well, I feel very badly.
No, I agree.
So,
well, here's what I would say.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that oftentimes there are disagreements among people along these lines. So when you argue about, mm-hmm. Any sort of, you know, moral relativism versus any sort of moral realism.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that if you and I, let's say, for sake of argument, you know, I'm a relativist and you're a realist and we're arguing, I would agree with you that if you get me to agree, foundationally suffering is bad, from there, then yes.
Mm-hmm.
But what I'm saying, so there shouldn't be too much disagreement other than what the actual consequences, maybe disagree on your views of what the consequences of an action are, or, you know, how much suffering it causes or to whom or whatever, or different weighting of suffering or something.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But
right.
We shouldn't be disagreeing too much on the underpinning of the morality, when sometimes we do. Sometimes there are people no, it's all relative, even though I personally don't like suffering either, and I want to minimize suffering. It's all relative, and you can't tell me that something's immoral, basically. And that I would disagree with. It's a fine distinction. I don't know if I'm making it well. But basically, I'm just talking about if we, you know, if we meet an android somewhere in the in space, and we don't even know much about it other than, you know, what it tells us, and it just doesn't have the same views. Like it maybe it doesn't know about suffering, doesn't, you know, feel suffering. Like it might have an entirely different morality, and I don't know exactly that you could say it's wrong, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, so I mean, this is part of why I wanted to bring this up with this particular book, is because, like, my views about moral realism are challenged by the existence of entities like Rorschach. Like, do we have a moral obligation? That's why I want to sort of extend this from just sentient beings to not to potentially not sentient beings. And this is why I asked
I'm excited for that, because I do not see how that would fall.
Yeah, well, this is why I asked you the question at the end of last episode, remember, right? I asked you, can it be the case that for a tree, let's assume that a tree is not sentient, that there's something it's like for that tree to flourish?
Yes, just as there's something it's like for the planet to revolve around the sun.
Yeah, and I'm fine with that, but like my point is, right, I think that there is something that it's that trees have interests is another way I want to put this, right? For a being to flourish, it has to have there has to be a way for things to go well for that being, right? It needs to get enough sunlight and water and all that sort of thing. And the reason I bring this up is because I think for something to be an object of moral consideration, it may not be necessary, but I do think it's sufficient if that being has interests. It may be the case that it doesn't even have to have interests.
I don't think a tree has interests. Are you saying a tree has interests?
Yeah. Well, I'm saying it has interests in the sense that it can either grow big and sort of have a good tree life, or die off and not have a good tree life, right? And
that I don't think there is a good or bad tree life. So this is good. I'm curious.
You tie value only to specifically sentient experience or sentient based interests.
Yeah,
it seems like.
I think it's our bias that we like trees and we need trees for oxygen and all, and we like how they look, that we would think of a tree in this way. I think you could make a comparison to, like, if I look at a small hill. Mm-hmm. And say, why isn't this hill a mountain? It's not flourishing. Like, it should be able to be a mountain.
Uh-huh.
But that's meaningless. And I actually think it's the same for the tree. It's just that we see progression of trees growing and we like it because we're monkeys. Like, honestly, that's what I think is going
on. Well, yeah. So you did bring up earlier, and I wanted to talk about this, what I think is the strongest debunking argument against moral realism, the challenge that my view faces the most is the evolutionary debunking argument. The idea that, again, going back to our book, just like sentience, morality might be an adaptation of a very, very strange, peculiar offshoot of evolutionary creatures.
Well, hold on. I'm not going that far.
I don't mean that in a condescending kind of way. What I mean is, you know, if we happen to evolve these sort of complex social sentient behaviors, then morality sort of arises as part of that system. And so it might be the case that, like, other beings would just never even develop anything like the concept of morality, potentially.
Right.
Right.
But I also would want to separate something, because just because there's a fallibility in the fact that we've evolved this, you know, like just the same way that we all have, like, or sorry, I won't say we all, but, you know, most people have a sex drive of some kind. Some people are asexual. They might not. But most people have a sex drive of some kind. But it doesn't mean that every action undertaken by that is like a good way to reproduce, even though the underpinning of our sex drive is, you know, reproduction evolutionarily.
Right.
So like what I mean to say is, just because we could have some fallible instincts or feelings about morality because of evolution, it doesn't mean that the underpinnings of it are like false or not valid.
Right, and that's one of the pushbacks that I'm sympathetic to from the moral realist perspective, if I'm understanding you correctly, is that, you know, just like we can be really bad at statistics or something because we evolve to be heuristic machines that don't need to think about large numbers, doesn't mean that we can't, as a species, gain knowledge about complex statistical calculations.
Well, maybe. Let me put it an easier way.
Okay.
I guess the point I'm making is regarding you and your tree that you're so in love with, tree boy. I think that it's like saying that, okay, like you, if you and I agree fully on like, yes, but even if I'll take moral realism, I'll just take that on and say, okay, we agree on all that crap. And we're like, yep, suffering, you get minimize that, all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
If I say, okay, well, when a little girl thinks that one of her dolls can suffer and like treats it a certain way because of instincts.
Yeah.
That's wrong. Like that's, I mean, that's fine that she's doing that, but it's not like, it's not strictly speaking correct. Like it doesn't, just because she feels that way about the doll doesn't mean that that's actually a more moral. Like if I put the doll in the closet, it doesn't mean I'm being immoral because I'm like mistreating and confining this thing. Right. It's just a misfiring of our instincts. And I think that's like you with the tree is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that if it were a person, sub in the person for the doll, then absolutely.
Right. And this is why you're a space vampire. And like, I'm sympathetic to that. And like,
no, I'm not. You're the space.
No, you're the space.
I'm not a puppet. No puppet.
Because like, I want to tie this back to our scramblers because they capture those two scramblers that I mentioned. And when they can't get them to speak and engage in language properly, they torture them. Essentially, they set up a system of like, you know, shocks and things to try to force them into communicating.
It's a really, really interesting part of the book. Right. And it was like I could barely keep up because it's super fascinating and complex.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But it was like the linguist's job was to like figure out their language, right?
Right.
And we could have done this in the expositions. Brian, repunch. Unpunch, repunch. No. But like, so it's really cool how they do it. You know, they're talking about like, okay, well, the only way to learn a language when something isn't going to let you in on it, you know, like it's kind of almost by force, is to try to harm them in some way. And then it's like you've got these two entities, they separate them. It's really fascinating. They separate them. And then if you harm one of them and give the other the information of how to stop the harm or something, then you can like figure out how they're communicating, and you kind of know, also, you know, certain things they have to be talking about because you know the information about how to stop the suffering. So that's how you like kind of force learn this language. But then it doesn't work, right? Because then if I have it right in the book, there was some portion of their communication that they just could not perceive. Like humans can't.
They just couldn't crack their, they're using like color on their skins in some complicated way.
Some amount of it was just like, imperceptible to humans or too complicated for us. So they never, I don't think the linguist ever cracked it, right? Or maybe they did at the end.
Yeah, not really. And like, but the major question here, of course, is she's really upset by having to do this because it feels to her like torturing a living being. And like the question is, well, but you know, if these things aren't sentient, then you can't torture something that's not sentient, right? So the question is, are the scramblers like your doll example? Are they like my tree example? Well, right? Like what moral status?
Here's what
they
I will say. Mm-hmm. I think we can sidestep our argument though, because I know you're trying to make the, do you have an obligation to a tree or whatever, the, you know, a non-sentient thing.
To
and
Rorschach.
I still disagree with you. And I think I can sidestep this point by saying, it may entirely be the case that we have a moral obligation in an ambiguous case to treat something that might be a conscious creature as though it is, because it's not worth the risk of harming something that can.
Okay, good. Right. So this is often the way this goes with artificial intelligence too, of course, right? Where it's like, if it acts sentient enough, we're likely going to treat it as such. Of course, then the problem becomes, you know, there's no fair features to point to on the external side of an entity to be certain, or even to be, I think, fully confident that there's something on the inside. Like, and in this book, they mostly just only manage to disprove sentience, or they think reasonably disprove it. But like, you know, do we know that the tree is not conscious? Like, it is really still an ambiguous case if you're being fully honest about the ambiguity of being able to have access to another being's first person perspective.
Yeah, we can't be 100% certain, but you know, every day people dump chemicals in their pool to kill the, you know, the plankton that lives in. Like, we're not staying up at night being worried about whether the algae that we kill
and
in our pool is sentient.
Maybe we should be. Right. Nah. I mean, like the fun thing about this is this argument expands out from here, from trees to things like do we have an ethical obligation to ecosystems as entities? Because there's something...
But I I want to make very clear the questions we're separating.
Yeah, okay.
If we are talking about because of ambiguity and because of not knowing for certain whether something's suffering, that to me is wholly different than
That wasn't what I was arguing for.
Okay.
I was arguing, even if the scrambler isn't sentient...
Okay.
Do we still have a moral obligation not to torture it if it's causing it harm in some kind of way?
I would say, well, hold on. What harm, though? Because I believe, like, if we're going with the idea that it is not sentient, then it can't feel pain, right? There's no...
Right, is but there we pain? Could still... I mean, let, you know, you imagine you have an animal that isn't sentient. You can still cut off a limb and cause it harm.
But I don't think we can imagine an animal that isn't sentient. I think that...
The scramblers are an animal that isn't sentient.
No, sorry, but I meant if you're comparing it to like an animal like here on Earth that we might like, that's not.
I mean,
so like a robot though. Are you talking about a robot?
Or you know, yeah, you could talk about a robot, but like you can cause harm to a robot too, right? You can cut off one of its robot arms. So like
okay,
the concept of harm,
okay,
it seems like
I want to make sure we.
Sentience.
No, because when I take apart my Roomba.
You're causing it harm.
No. I'm not. No. Okay. No. By your definition, am I causing it harm?
That's
what I want to be very clear about.
So,
because I don't think I am.
Well,
I think I'm free to take apart
my
Roomba all
I
want.
This is the problem that I've been wrestling with since I read this book. I'll be real honest with you. That like because you know switching gears just for
no,
a
for
second.
For me, the only problem is the ambiguity. I'm not with you in the harm.
I don't think
thing.
It's just
the
problem is the ambiguity because
yeah, I do.
No, here's the thing, right? Think back to when we talked about Daniel Dennett and like the Chinese Room and his pushback on it that like there's no bright line between functional systems of different levels of complexity that like you can have, you know, if the being acts functionally from the outside, that's all there is that matters. So if the being recoils as if it's in pain, that's all there is to being in pain.
But that's still the ambiguity part.
Well, no,
that's still
the ambiguity is a question of what you can tell from the outside. I'm saying he's not actually saying it's an ambiguity situation. He's saying the idea that there's these distinct phenomenally conscious entities in some kind of way is the actual illusion, because he thinks that his view collapses into illusionism. And so like he thinks that the Nagel Cyril kind of view of the like something it's like to be the being on the inside is all just fundamentally misguided, and that like we are all scramblers in a sense. We're just scramblers
but
that have enough.
Okay, yeah. I guess to separate this cleanly, you could make a robot that we are virtually assured is not capable of feeling suffering. I mean, nobody thinks that a Roomba can feel suffering, right?
Right.
Are we gonna?
Right.
If that's what your argument rests on, then there's not
no,
worth doing.
No, I'm not. Like, I'm not going there.
I get the idea that when you come upon a scrambler, that it is an alien thing. You don't know. It's ambiguous. I that is a tough question, especially if you're in a situation where it's like, well, in order to save humans, we might have to like abuse these things that we're not quite sure whether or not they're sentient. That's a really tough moral question. But for me, that's only because of the ambiguity. If someone designs a robot, a simple robot, but that like has like a face drawn on it, and then it also emits a sound when you take off its arm, it emits a sound that, like it's from The Good Place. You
right,
know,
right,
oh,
yeah.
don't kill me. Don't kill me. Ow, you know,
yep.
Like there's no ambiguity there. It's just that, yes, this thing is tricking us into thinking it's being harmed, but if we know that it's not being harmed, you know, then we don't have any obligation to it, despite the sounds it's making.
Yeah, and I am sympathetic to this. And on the other hand, there is a part of me that has a strong intuition that even if the scrambler is not sentient, and even if Rorschach is not sentient, I still feel, and same thing with the vampire, even if the vampires aren't sentient, I still wonder if we have a moral obligation to them. And I feel, and I don't think that it's just a misfiring to wonder about that, because I think that they're, because like, I don't think that sentient suffering is the only moral foundation that matters. I think that beings that have the capacity for what, we'll say what appears to be autonomous behavior, So respecting autonomy is another thing that I think matters. And obviously, you know, my views on free will and like they complicate my views on autonomy. But I think that another
Does
thing that's
something
morally
that's
important.
Not sentient have autonomy, like autonomous?
Yes, it's another, God, we need another episode on this. It's a very complicated
because
question.
Because I think, no, this is great. I love this discussion though.
Yeah.
Because I think that what you're talking about is sort of like if I said, look, gravity wants to take things to the ground. The earth wants, it is autonomously wants, that. Clearly, if I'm holding an object and I stop holding it, it goes to the ground. That's what wants to happen. So we have a moral obligation to let that happen. That's what I think you're saying.
Well, I mean,
and I think it's an illusion, man.
I think the way I would charitably put that is that the more you stare at this stuff, the harder it gets to separate things that we qualify as just forces of nature from things that we would qualify as autonomous agents. Like, is Rorschach just autonomous, or is it a force of nature? Like, is it just like a hurricane in crystallized demon form, or is it?
Well, what?
Yeah.
The crucial point I'm trying to make is that I really think it depends on, like, if it's an ambiguous thing, then absolutely that's a different question. But if we want to separate these things and stipulate that this is a philosophical zombie or whatever, like this is a thing that doesn't have an internal experience, then in that stipulated world where we know it doesn't have the phenomenal consciousness and experience of suffering, then I do think it is like a force of nature. I think it is like gravity. It's just a complex set of forces that have, you know, come together somehow to move around in the world. Well, I think it's true.
No, I mean, I think it's super funny because I've been wrestling with this in regard to my theories about moral luck and, like, what's the difference between a sociopath and a volcano? And I've come to really genuinely think that there's no difference, and that if we're going to say that the sociopath is acting immorally, we have to in effect say that the volcano is acting immorally, and that's the bullet that I'm willing to bite in this conversation. That, like, if Rorschach tries to kill Theseus, it's acting immorally, and if we try to kill, like, is it immoral to commit a first strike against Rorschach? Maybe, like, maybe it's different, and it's like it's an important.
I think that's different.
I mean, I think it's
the volcano. You're talking about harming conscious creatures. The Rorschach thing, you're not.
See, that's, and I think that things matter more than consciousness. I think that things like complexity and uniqueness and flourishing are things that can matter even if
Let's continue this argument after dark. Okay. We're way over time, but it's such an interesting discussion. I'm really enjoying this. we'll keep going on it and see if I you know, I'm just trying to get Aaron to realize he's wrong. So, you know, that's always fun.
It's okay. I'll be killed off by the vampires and then it won't be a problem.
I'm just trying to get you to realize you're playing with a doll and getting mad when I put the doll away.
I'm just trying to get you to realize that we're dolls all the way down, man.
Yeah. All right. Oh, so much fun. Okay. Well, wow. We did three of these, which means that Blindsight is officially this as good as Dune.
Yeah, it reaches Dune
level. I feel
like
we gotta do 90 of these. If Dune was a 3-peat, this should be a 10-peat.
So judgy.
I like Blindsight more than Dune, but that's okay. That's okay.
Good. I'm glad I didn't make you read Dune, so stop complaining.
You're right. Sorry. No, sorry. I'm sure the Dune books are great. Anyway, do you have a preview for us for next week?
Yeah, well, this month we are celebrating Star Wars.
All right, that's it. Dishonor. Dishonor on your whole family. Make a note of this. Dishonor on you. Dishonor on your cow.
Yeah, oh, I'm sorry. Start that over, Brian.
Leave it in. Leave it in.
Yeah, so this month we...
The person you are worried about offending is Brian anyway. So it's not going to matter. He's already... The damage is done. He already heard you not know whether you're talking about Star Wars.
I blanked in that moment, man. It's so bad. I'm so busy thinking about Rorschach and these moral questions. I'm like, which space opera are we watching? Yeah.
Yeah, so Star Rorschach.
We're watching Star Rorschach. yes, we are talking Star Wars. So we're doing a NASA on Star Wars. So our patrons are definitely going to get to hear that. And I wanted to do a little bit of the original Star Wars movies. So I was thinking we could start by doing A New Hope and talking about the ethics of guerrilla asymmetric rebel warfare, right? The the old sort of adage that one man's terrorist and another man's freedom fighter.
Yeah.
And then we'll get into
back to politics. I like it.
Yeah, a little bit of politics. And then we'll talk a little Taoism with Yoda, I think, 2 weeks out. So that's our forecast.
Well, and I can't wait. Can we announce that Brian's coming aboard for the NASA?
He's going to punch
Brian
it in person.
Brian is Mr. Star War. Like, I don't know if I've mentioned this before. He's Mr. Wars.
Yep.
And that's awesome because I can't wait to do a NASA with him. It's going
to
be fun.
Yeah. And I'm happy to announce that even he struggled his way through this NASA. So we're not going to have to listen to rosy, happy, this is actually a good movie.
Oh, well, that's too bad. I was kind of hoping for that. All right. Well, that's fine.
I'll do my best to make it into a satire.
All right. And then, of course, we've got to thank our top patrons over at patreon.com/zeroG. What are they going to make you say this week?
Yeah, thanks to our $25 tier, strong AI patrons, Jesta O, the meek shall inherit the earth, the rest of us will go to the stars, Corey Ebert, Winchesters never die, the look on Nunez's face is my favorite look on anyone's face ever, let's get serious about this whole cult thing, and, most of all, Anathem. And thank you so much, Double Utils, all the Utils, thanks to our $50 tier, absolutely positively, not a clone patrons, Philip Gatt, give me those sweet, sweet Utils, and Brian, punch it. I never get to say that one. That's actually a lot of fun. Okay, thank you so all. Thank you all so much. Really appreciate it.
All right, that's our show. Thanks so much for listening. We've still got plenty of arguing to do. It's very interesting philosophical arguing, I think, in my opinion. Over on the, not like the usual thing, like, you know, Thanos couldn't do that or something. It's actually good substantive philosophy. Over on After Dark, so hop onto the Patreon, join us After Dark. We always have fun discussions afterward, every show. We'll see you over on the After Dark. If not, we'll see you next week.
That's all for the main show, but if you'd like to go to patreon.com/zeroG, you can enjoy Philosophers in Space After Dark. Here's a little sneak peek for you.
You know, we're just fighting about moral truths.
This has been a burst transmission of Philosophers in Space. All music written and performed by Thomas Smith. If you've enjoyed your infotainment upload, please locate the nearest podcast interface device and fill it with 5-star ratings and glowing reviews. If you think Ground Control should spring for fun new goodies and content, consider supporting us at patreon.com/zeroG. You can find us on Twitter at zeroG Philosophy, where Aaron will instantly and compulsively respond. Or you can email us at philosophersinspace@gmail.com. Finally, if you're sad that it takes so long for our signals to reach Earth, you can always find Thomas over at Serious Inquiries Only and Opening Arguments, and Aaron over at Embrace the Void. Until next time, live long and philosopher.